Just to follow up on that question, after the 98 bombing attacks, there essentially were no more military actions taken except in Iraq. And I find it a little curious that we were bombing virtually every day in Iraq, but were reluctant to go after the conveyor belt that Clark's talk about at the same time.
Well, there were other military actions in Bosnia and Kosovo, but I'm sure you're not referring to those. We discussed at various times, Mr. Secretary, whether serial bombing of the camps, intermittent bombing of the camps, 2 weeks of bombing of the camps, 17 days bombing of the camps was a sensible option. It was a subject of many discussions. And I think the judgment that we reached, that we came to, was that to use military power in that way and not to get to get bin Laden, not to get any of his top lieutenants, but to use our military power to bomb the camps, kill a bunch of people, sure, knock down a bunch of jungle gyms, as Hugh Shelton would describe them, would actually have strengthened bin Laden and al-Qaeda, glorified him, and made us look weak. And that's why we were constantly seeking intelligence with respect to leadership targets that would have enabled that to have some greater force.
One last question, and that is on the coal. Since Clark used the word Talmudic, frankly, your response on waiting and you didn't really know about coal sounds a little Talmudic. I mean, the time to retaliate for the coal would have been the day after the coal, because as you have rightly pointed out, the administration was basically at war with al-Qaeda, and there was certainly enough evidence, although admittedly not to the satisfaction of the Justice Department perhaps and their evidentiary rules, but it was certainly not the IRA that blew up the coal. And you knew that there had been a previous al-Qaeda attempt on the Sullivan in the same harbor. Why wasn't there enough action to retaliate? I mean, enough evidence.
I believe before the president uses military force in retaliation that he needs a clear judgment from his senior advisors. That they're responsible. The day after Pan Am 103, we would have bombed Syria, Mr. Secretary.
But you just told us.
May I finish? We thought TWA 800 was terrorism. It was not terrorism. People, actually, dozens of people, saw the missile strike TWA 800 as it went up over Long Island.
Yeah, but you just told us.
Preliminary judgments, I have come to learn, are not the same as judgments. And when the CIA was ready, they were certainly not sitting on their hands. And when they were ready to come back and say, it's our best judgment that this is al-Qaeda, we should have acted. That did not happen on our watch, sir.
But, in fact, it did happen on your watch. It happened in November and
your
December.
Own staff, sir, says it didn't happen on our watch. Well, your own staff says there was a preliminary judgment.
I differ with you on that, but the fact is, the reality is that you've already testified that if you'd have found bin Laden out in the open, you would have attacked him anyway, even without the coal being
correct.
Hit. But you wouldn't attack him because of the coal. That's a little...
No, I don't follow you, sir, but what I'm saying is I believe that when responsibility was ascribed for the coal, I certainly would have recommended a strong response, including a response against the Taliban, because in January of 2000, we had warned the Taliban if there was any other attack by bin Laden and al-Qaeda, we would hold them responsible. So this turns on what's the threshold of action. And I think a preliminary judgment, which is what your staff statement describes it as, a preliminary judgment, is not sufficient for the president to sustain, to go to the world and saying, I've gone to war with Afghanistan on the basis of a preliminary judgment or on the basis of, quite honestly, Dick Clark's opinion. When the CIA came back and said, "Sir, we believe this is Al Qaeda," I believe I would have been in favor of acting. I don't think we were at that point, and I'd seen enough situations in my 8 years where preliminary judgments were wrong. The Egypt airplane that went down was terrorism. Oklahoma City, sir, was foreign terrorism for quite some time until we found out that it wasn't foreign terrorism. So I want to see I want to see the director of Central Intelligence, at least as the chief advisor to the President on Intelligence, come to the President and say, "Mr. President, there's no certainties in this world. We can't be 100% sure. But we believe that this is an Al-Qaeda operation." And at that point, I think it would have been ripe for action.
Thank you very much.
I've got one quick question just to follow up, really. Have you read this book, Ghost Wars?
No, I've just read the two excerpts, Governor, from the Washington Post.
Yeah, it's a good book. I mean, it confirms a lot of what we're finding out in this investigation, as I'd recommend it. But one of the things it does detail, similar to our findings, is that there was a real disconnect. There was a real disconnect between what you all believed was the policy in Washington and what was going on in Afghanistan, including the famous comment by Massoud when he was told, when he was read an order, a legal opinion, as to what could be done and couldn't be done with bin Laden. And I guess my question is, it seems a fact to me anyway from the book and from our research that there was this disconnect. You were meeting every day. I mean, you were meeting every week anyway. You have principles and everything else. You had a clear understanding of what was going on. How could this occur? How could
Perhaps that's a question you should direct. You should ask the director of Central Intelligence, because there was no communication, or Kofor Black, who was in the White House twice a week, and never took me aside and said, "Sandy, we got a real problem in the field because the instructions are confusing, or we got a lot more capacity to act than you've given to us." Never. Never.
There was somewhere that was disconnected.
It
obviously affected policy.
I would say one thing about that, though, and I think Director Tenner mentioned it this morning. You got a lot of stovepipes in this government, and someone who is sitting down there at the sixth level or the seventh level, or a soldier who is on a battleship, or a CIA operative who's out in the field, doesn't have 360-degree vision on what's going on. So all he knows or she knows is what she is ready to do and willing to do, and may not know about the whole picture. That's why you've got to channel this through, in an integrated system, one central person.
Mr. Chairman.
It's just, Governor Thompson is next.
Yes, I understand. There is a document which we have recently received from CIA, and I don't know how much about it we can discuss. But it would shed light on the issue of what CIA operatives in the field told Mr. Massoud at the appropriate time. And I will tell you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm sure you have not yet seen that document, that it removed ambiguity in terms of whether Mr. Massoud would be rewarded, whether or not bin Laden was killed or captured.
Mr. Governor, the only last thing let you proceed.
Okay, Governor Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Governor James Thompson, former Republican governor of Illinois.
Mr. Berger, thank you for your testimony today and for your service to our country. And I will repeat something I said yesterday. I don't know whether you heard it or not, but that I was complimentary of the Clinton administration for its vigorous pursuit of terrorists, Al-Qaeda, EUBL, and all those things that you have testified to this morning. On page 3 of your prepared remarks, there are two paragraphs that I think, in essence, you've discussed here today. I'll just highlight them. It was our judgment that to fire on primitive camps and fail to destroy bin Laden or key al-Qaeda figures would have fortified bin Laden and made the U.S. look weak and feckless. And given the circumstances that prevailed at the time, including no support from Pakistan or other neighbors, no base near Afghanistan, and no lead-time intelligence, the military leadership concluded that such a mission, that is, boots on the ground in Afghanistan, would fail. Those were the conclusions yesterday, as I understood the testimony from Cohen, Albright, Powell, Rumsfeld, and this morning from Tenet. And so you associate yourself with those views from those five people?
Yes.
Okay. When did you brief Condi Rice about terrorism?
Well, as you, of course, recall, we had somewhat of a truncated transition because we had an elongated election. I think I met with Dr. Rice on three occasions, and then she received specific briefings from several members of my staff, an hour, 2 hour briefings, along with her deputy and perhaps others. In my first briefing with her, we talked about this issue. I wanted very much to convey to her
the Al-Qaeda, sense, you discussed Al-Qaeda?
Yes.
Yes.
I wanted very much to convey to her the sense of urgency that I felt, because they had been out of government for some time, and the world had changed. And I said to her at that time, and she's acknowledged this publicly, that the number one issue that you're going to be dealing with is terrorism, and generally, and Al-Qaeda specifically. Then she had a specific factual briefing, Governor, from, I believe, Mr. Clark and his team. And I went to no other briefings that she went to, staff briefings, except that one. And I showed up at that briefing at the beginning, and I said, Gandhi, I'm here simply to emphasize how important this is. I'm not going to stay through the whole thing, but I just wanted to underscore how important I think this is. So in every way that I knew how, Governor, I tried to convey that this was our top priority as a country.
So when Mr. Clark says in this book that nobody will acknowledge they've read except members of the commission.
I'm eager to read it. I haven't had a chance.
I'm sure you will be. When he said that in his meeting with the National Security Advisor, Ms. Rice, I'll quote, "As I briefed Rice on Al-Qaeda, her facial expression gave me the impression that she had never heard the term before. So since you discussed it with her, that impression of Mr. Clark's would be erroneous. Is that correct?"
I can't comment on that, Governor. I wasn't present. I don't know the circumstances of that. I don't know what the sequence was, quite honestly, of my meeting with her and Dick's meeting with her. All I can tell you is what I said to her and what I did.
Okay. Going to page 7 of your prepared remarks, and I don't want to give the impression I'm picking on this or poaching on my friend Kerry's territory in discussing the cold, but he's finally moved me to the point where I think I need to. And your testimony this morning seems to be somewhat at odds with Director Tenet's testimony this morning, so I just want to get it clear in my own head. You say on page 7 of your prepared statement, "By the time President Clinton left office, however, neither the CIA nor the FBI had reached firm conclusions that Al-Qaeda was responsible for that assault, that is, the coal. Director Tenet told us this morning, as I recall his testimony, that during December, when the Clinton administration was still in office, the CIA had reached the judgment that Al-Qaeda was responsible because the assault was carried out by known Al-Qaeda operatives," I think was his phrase. "They just couldn't conclude that Osama bin Laden had command and control over that operation." Can you shed some light on this apparent difference?
I'm reading now from your staff statement this morning, which says, "On the issue of the coal, the Bush administration received essentially the same quote, preliminary judgment
mm-hmm.
that had been briefed to the Clinton administration in December. And I listened to George this morning, and it was a little bit hard to track, which he usually isn't. But all I can tell you is that what we were told was that, and the evidence led to, pointed to al-Qaeda for sure. And they were, and that preliminary judgment was that it was al-Qaeda. I believe a very sharp response would have been called for after the call. I believe to have sustained that in the court of world opinion, you would have need the president would have stood up and said, based on the preliminary judgment of my intelligence community today, I bombed Afghanistan. I just don't think that would have cut it.
Well, but as I understand Director Tenet's testimony, he could have stood up and said, we know that specific al-Qaeda operatives bombed the Kohl.
Well, I can't comment on Director Tenet's testimony because I was not watching it without doing some other things at the same time, like finishing my own statement. But I will tell you my own recollection, sir.
Sure.
And what is, I think, the record, and that is that that in December we were increasingly convinced that it was al-Qaeda, that the CIA had reached a preliminary judgment to that effect, but they still had work to do and did not have a judgment, strike the word preliminary. At that point, I think we would have been faced with a policy decision. As Mr. Tenet made clear, that's not his decision. It's for the president, ultimately, of how to respond.
One last point. You made somewhat of a reference to the fact that you thought that Osama bin Laden or al-Qaeda aside, the Taliban, Afghanistan, bore some responsibility in this as well, and you had specifically warned them that if this happened again, and this was pre-Kohl, they would be held responsible as well. I agree with that. And in all this sort of back and forth about whether there were suitable targets in Afghanistan and whether we should go bomb the camps one more time, whether there were people there or not, just to show our resolve, it is a fact, is it not, that there were targets in Afghanistan that belonged to the Taliban, to Afghanistan, their civil seat of government, Mullah Omar's house, I'm sure we knew where that was. Would you, under the right circumstances, have concurred in a decision to take it out on the Taliban as well?
I can only speak for myself
sure.
personally, Governor. That would have been my personal recommendation, given the warning that we gave in January of 2000, we would have struck not just whatever al-Qaeda targets were available, but we would have struck Taliban targets as well. Now, we've since learned the Taliban was prepared to be destroyed
mm-hmm.
Rather than give up bin Laden. So they were fused at the hip. I think that's a judgment that we reached in mid-1999 and early 2000, that it would be very difficult to break the Taliban from al-Qaeda.
Thank you, Mr. Berger. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kerry.
Mr. Berger, I noticed, and I appreciate you're a private citizen now, and I saw you back there working on your statement,
this
so
is
it may just be an oversight.
Former Senator Bob Kerry of Nebraska.
Draw attention to the February 23, 1998 press conference that Osama bin Laden held in Khost, Afghanistan, and that he brought that he, with a satellite telephone, delivered to an Arabic-speaking newspaper in London. This seems, as I read it, it reads like a declaration of war. And I wonder if that's just an oversight or whether or not you don't believe that that's an important
Senator Kerry, I've watched the prior testimony yesterday and your statements to that on this subject. I believe we were at war with al-Qaeda. Number one, the president sounded the alarm I have just something for the record here.
But just help me.
Let me answer. No,
actually, before you do that, because I get 5 minutes here, and I know where you're going, and I just do you regard the 23rd February 98 declaration as a strategically important?
Absolutely, the fatwas were terribly important. The document I wanted to show you. This is it's not like we weren't talking about the terrorism. The Taliban, Afghanistan. We sounded the alarm. Number two, we used all the instruments that we had available to us, whether those were military or covert or otherwise.
I
think we were at war with the Taliban.
Sandy, I've got five. I didn't have enough time to compliment you in the way that I would like to have done. But let's presume that I had 15 minutes to deliver compliments about all the things you're doing. I think you're a great strategic thinker. But when your statement doesn't include that.
I only had 10 minutes of my statement.
So okay, but regard the 23rd February press conference in Khost, Afghanistan as a declaration of war against the United States?
I regarded all of the fatwas, I mean, there were several of them, as growing indication that this individual was a strategic, legal threat to the United States.
Even Dr.
There's more than that file. There's more than that. Your case is stronger than you're making. It's not just one. It's not one press conference. He issued several fatwas.
Not just several fatwas. He declared his willingness and then demonstrated his capability to kill Americans, and he was in Afghanistan. And I keep scratching my head and wondering. Even Dr. Rice, at the end of an eight month planning process, comes up with a three-part plan. First part is continued diplomacy to try to get Osama bin Laden released from the Taliban. That was part number one of the plan. And it seems to me, and it's reasonable, by the way, it's not unreasonable to say, under the circumstances, we just didn't regard this as a strategic threat comparable, for example, to the problems that we were having between Pakistan and India, because I regard this as an enormously important strategic moment, and I understand that I've got hindsight looking back on it, and I see it that way perhaps a bit more than I did on the 23rd of February 1998. But it seems as well to, if you regard it as a declaration of war, it would seem to dictate everything that follows afterwards, and it would seem to rule out any diplomacy with the Taliban to try to get the release of bin Laden.
I go back farther than that, Senator. I consider from at least August 20th, 1998, when he attacked our embassies and when we could establish that it was responsibility of al-Qaeda, that we were at war with al-Qaeda. And that was one further piece of evidence,
but
as well as other
files. We only used military against a person who had declared war on us, against whom we declared war. We only used our military against them one time, the 20th of August, 1998.
There are three ways to use military, Senator, seems to me. Number one, we could have invaded Afghanistan. I do not believe, and I know you may disagree with this, I do not believe before September 11th that the American people or the international community would have supported a invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, which already, since 9/11, has gone on for 2.5 years in the absence before 9/11. Mm-hmm. We could have used force by using special forces, which we constantly went back to General Shelton and Secretary Cohen and said, what are the options here? The options were lousy. We could have used force by bombing camps that were empty or that were jungle gyms, and killed 25 or 30 or 40 al-Qaeda operatives. And the next day, bin Laden would have had a press conference, and he would have been sitting on top of that cruise missile waving at us in contempt. So use force how? I think before 9/11, the one way to use force to eliminate al-Qaeda, it seems to me, in its sanctuary, would be to invade Afghanistan. I do not believe that this country was ready to invade Afghanistan before September 11th, notwithstanding the fact we had a president who in 1996 said, this is the challenge of our generation. This is the threat of our generation.
I don't, I mean, the, you, you persuaded the American people that military effort was necessary in Bosnia. You didn't have the House of Representatives with you. You barely had a majority in the Senate. You persuaded the American people that war was necessary to get Slobodan Milosevic to stop his terror in Kosovo.
Yeah, and we also had 19 and again, democracies in NATO in both of those cases that were standing with us together.
Saying, the point is only that if you the argument that I find to be most unpersuasive is to say we couldn't have gotten it done because nobody had been with us. Because there are several examples during the Clinton administration where you all wanted to do something, you believed it was important, and you came to the American people over and over and over, I thought heroically and correctly, to get public opinion on your side. That's what it's all about. If you'd have come to Congress and said, we're at war, somebody's just declared war on us, and I could understand not doing it until the 7th of August. But after the 7th of August, it seems to me that should have been the U.S. declaration. And our every policy option that we had should have followed that. And all diplomacy should have been abandoned.
I think we were at war after the 7th of August.
Done.
Using military covert instruments, rolling back al-Qaeda cells, trying to put as much economic and other pressure on the Taliban. What we did not do is invade Afghanistan. And we'll just have to disagree on this, Senator. I do not believe that was conceivable before 9/11.
Congressman Romer.
This is Congressman Tim Romer of Indiana, retired.
Through the Clinton years and fighting terrorism. Thank you for your time today, and thank you for the thoughtful recommendations that you put in your statement. I hope we get a chance to discuss those
a little bit,
since part of our mandate is to look forward and try to make the country safer. Let me, without beating a dead horse or poking a dead horse or embalming a dead horse here, poke a little bit more on the USS Cole. In our staff statement, we say that there was an exchange between you and Mr. Tenet where Mr. Tenet ended up walking out of the room. Was that over the USS Cole?
You know, I read that, and I do remember. Obviously, first of all, George Tenet is a good, close, cherished friend of mine. Passions run strong sometimes on issues such as this, and I do remember there was one episode where George left early and suddenly. But I can't honestly say that.
Was he in a good mood or a bad mood when he left?
He was not in a good mood at me, but I can't honestly remember exactly what the proximate cause of that was.
Do you remember the approximate date for his bad mood?
No, I don't. It didn't happen often. Didn't happen.
There's a great deal of frustration, I think, for some of us in looking back, as you said, through the rear view mirror, which is easier to do, and we see some of these preliminary judgments put forward by the CIA, where they can't get command and control up to Osama bin Laden, but it was definitely operatives of al-Qaeda. And we have a tough time understanding then why we can't go forward and retaliate against al-Qaeda generally. Did you, in your frustration and your concern about this, did you try to push the president on a more forward-leaning, aggressive approach to the guilt with respect to the USS Cole?
I think that I believed that the CIA and the FBI was doing everything possible. Now, we had some problems with the Yemenis during the Cole investigation, and they were restricting some access to some of our people. And the President of the United States called the President of Yemen, I believe, on two occasions, but certainly on one occasion.
This is under a Yemeni investigation, an FBI and a CIA, and he's calling on the...
And the President's called the President of Yemen and said, you've got to cooperate with our people. We're not going to put up with this. And that problem was resolved. Obviously, there were an awful lot of Americans suddenly swarming into Yemen after the Cole. So we were providing support to the CIA and the FBI as they conducted their investigation. I don't believe they were dragging their feet.
I know I'm putting you in a difficult position with both Mr. Tenet and the President, but back to my question. Do you recall trying to push the president times.
I wasn't trying to be non-responsive, Congressman. I don't believe there was, because I don't believe they were dragging their feet. I left off the first half of my sentence. I mean, I don't think that our perception was that they need a kick. They needed a kick in the rear end on this. I mean, my view was that the highest levels of the CIA felt the same. You know, George and I talked about this issue, you know, behind my closed door, two or three times a week in 1999 and 2000. And I had no doubt in my mind that he felt the same sense of urgency that I did.
Back to the briefing.
Last question, Congressman.
Back to the briefing that you gave to Dr. Rice, which you have said several times, and I think that she's acknowledged. Did that briefing include any reference to sleeper cells in the United States? I know the Clinton administration had done an after-action report on the Millennium and found presence of sleeper cells. Did you brief that, or did Mr. Clark, or did anybody else brief administration officials on that particular aspect?
There was two parts of my interaction with Dr. Rice. One was in my office, in one of the two or three times that we had a chance to meet during the transition. She was still in California. She was commuting back and forth. As I've already reported on that conversation, there was a detailed, specific, factual slideshow briefing that she was given, along with others. That was conducted by Mr. Clark. I came to the beginning of that in the Situation Room and said, I wanted to show up to show up. I wanted to show up because I wanted to emphasize how important this was as far as I was concerned, and I stayed perhaps for the first 5 minutes, and then I left. So I don't know what the substance of that briefing was and whether specifically sleeper cells came up.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Congressman. Commissioner Feeling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Berger.
This is Commissioner Fred Fielding.
Yes, three brief things. I'm just to kind of fill in some blanks. First of all, following up on Commissioner Romer, you know, we're studying an event that is a colossal and tragic failure of our system. And there was one bright light as we're looking through this, and that was the Millennium Plot. And the success of the Millennium Plot in averting problems. And as I understand, there was commissioned and presented in March of 2000 an after-action report on that. To your knowledge, was that after-action report ever shared with the incoming administration?
Well, let me put it in context. First of all, I requested the after-action report.
Okay.
It was presented to me in February. We had a principals meeting on it on March 10th. There were 29 recommendations. They basically were accepted, subject in some cases to funding. Some of them, a lot of them had to do with domestic security issues. The president then submitted a $300 million supplemental to the Congress for additional money and reprogrammed $79 million within the CIA budget to counterterrorism. Some of those recommendations were implemented. As we learned since 9/11, some of them were not. I do not know whether or not that was presented to Dr. Rice, but of course the people who had originally drafted it were still at the White House.
Okay, so we should look elsewhere for the answer to
right.
that. Okay, thank you. Now, I thought I had the authorities issue nailed down until that you said something.
Okay, I'm sorry if I confused
you. But you said that in your interpretation, what George Tenet was saying was that the capacity was the real issue, and that if he had the chance to do a kill, he would have gone and gotten the authority to do it.
I believe that to be the case, and I believe that to be the way I heard Mr. Tenet this morning.
Right, but if that's the case, that's what I thought too, but if that's the case, wouldn't the inference be that he didn't have the authority
No, he didn't have the capability.
No, but wouldn't it also be the inference?
You know, these MONs, you know, they're not, I mean, Talmudic is one way to describe them, but
so
the instructions, it was not your description.
You can use Jesuitical if you'd rather.
Yeah, I'm not going to offend 5.5 million
people.
I've had
some influence on laymen in the interim.
Right.
John, please move down
here. They're drafted with the CIA, often usually drafted initially at the CIA. The instructions to the field are drafted by the CIA. We don't draft them at the NSC. So my view was, did some of these say, some of these were strictly, some of these authorities, and I'm on very thin ice here, and Chairman will rule me out of order if I get too far. Some of these authorities were explicitly involved killing. Some of the authorities were capture or kill. We didn't open up the spider hole in Iraq and blow out Saddam Hussein's brains. Capturing has some value. If we could bring this guy back and mine his and shake him down, that would be a good thing. But there was never any question in my mind that if capture was not possible, kill was acceptable. And that if they wanted more explicit authority, if that was ambiguous, if they thought that the capture was a predicate to kill, an attempted capture, I mean, I imagined a confrontation with bin Laden in which there'd be a lot of guns fired, and chances are he'd be killed. And maybe if we were lucky, we catch a convoy and somebody be able to get his car, but no one's going to take, none of the people we were dealing with were going to take a heck of a lot of a risk to do that. So, you know, I anticipated he would be killed. I also believed that if Director Tenet wanted more explicit authority, more specific authority, more targeted authority, he certainly understood that he could come back to the White House, and he had a very sympathetic president and a very sympathetic national security advisor.
Okay, well, thank you. Let me just, one last thing, because I've been trying to run something to ground, and yes, Mr. Chairman. But when we're talking about the three occasions between December 98 and mid-99, I'm particularly trying to get a handle on who and why the so-called desert camp incident was aborted. And what happened there? Nobody seems to say, well, it was our decision. There seemed to be really good intelligence, and it went for a period of days, and then suddenly it was aborted. So
I cannot distinguish that incident from the two or three other incidents where I would get information either from Mr. Clark or from Mr. Tenet that we had some opportunity, that we were watching this very, very carefully. Stay tuned. I would get then authorization from all of the principals and put the president on alert that something might be possible. In each of those cases, the director of the CIA would come back to me and say, I do not believe we have reliable enough intelligence to recommend going forward. And we did discuss it, as he said this morning. It was interactive. But there was never a situation in which we were presented information that bin Laden was here and we didn't take it because of civilian casualties or any other reason. The only other thing I would add is I've been told that a subsequent review of that episode suggests that bin Laden never was there. I don't know whether that's true or not. At the time, we were told the assessment was that there was not reliable information. And the judgment was that to fire a bunch of cruise missiles, or as the President Bush has said, $10 million cruise missiles to knock down a $10 tent, would have made bin Laden look stronger, glorified him in the Islamic world, created more terrorists, and not made us look stronger or advance the cause of fighting terrorism.
But there was an after-action report.
I'm sure there was.
Okay. Thank you.
Let me correct the record. I'm not sure there was. Okay. I believe there was, Mr. Fielding, and I remember being told that, and I've never seen it after action report. Okay.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
My last questioner before lunch will be Commissioner Gorelick.
It's dangerous to stand.
This is former Deputy Attorney General Jamie Gorelick.
Very quick questions then. First of all, as I understand it, you have now associated yourself with the comments of Secretaries Albright, Powell, Rumsfeld, Cohen, echoing the testimony of Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz, that it would have been impossible, both in terms of Pakistan's willingness to provide the necessary assistance and in terms of the Congress of the United States, to have invaded Afghanistan in the way that would have been necessary to tear down the Taliban and get bin Laden prior to 9/11. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it would not have been feasible and it would not have been sustainable either domestically or internationally.
Second of all, while we cannot discuss, we were not able to discuss the issue of covert authorities other than in vague generalities with Director Tenet. He did say that if he wanted more authority from you, if he wanted to clarify an ambiguity with you, it is his view that it was his obligation to come to you. Is that your understanding as well?
Absolutely, yes, although it could have worked the other way as well. If I had something that I wanted him to think about, I'm sure he would have entertained it. But generally, if he had more capability, he would have come back to us and say, we need more authority.
Third, with respect to this issue of the coal, just assume with me for the moment that on January 25th, when there was a new administration, the CIA's advice to that new administration was equally as hedged as it was when you left office, and that administration made no conclusion with regard to responsibility for the coal until the president announced post 9/11 that it was a responsibility of al-Qaeda. Do you think that administration had an obligation until the advice was unhedged, if you will, to take action in retaliation for the coal?
Let me say this. This is not a static situation. This information is developing every day, every day. They're getting more information. The investigation gets farther, more conclusive. As we left, it was a preliminary judgment. As they came in, it was a preliminary judgment. I think the point at which it no longer became a preliminary judgment, it became a judgment, there was a would have been a responsibility to make a decision with respect to whether how to respond.
I would make two factual comments just as a commissioner here. Number one, our staff has a view on whether the CIA's hedging was appropriate based upon the factual record that we have. And number two, Deputy National Security Advisor Hadley has told us that his administration's response would come via this new policy that was in the works in the spring and summer of 01. Thank you very much for your testimony and your service to the country.
Sarah, I have one last question. We're through, but this question comes from
Governor
members,
Tom
from family
Kane.
Members, so I wanted to make sure and ask it. Prior to 9/11, did you have any intelligence that planes could be used as missiles?
I saw no intelligence which drew our attention to that as any more likely than truck bombs, car bombs, assassinations, embassies. What I'm saying is there were hundreds of thousands of pieces of intelligence. Were there, I take it from the Graham Goss report, there were a number of documents which talked about that. But I do not recall ever being told that this was a modality that was likely, any more likely than others. Indeed, I think we were the intelligence took us to other kinds of methods of terrorism rather than this one.
Thank you very much, Mr. Berger. Thank you very much for your testimony, and thank you for your service. We have additional questions later on. I hope we can get them to you. I do have a note from the Capitol Police saying, please do not leave unattended bags or packages on your chairs or seats or in the room, or they may not be here when you get back. We're going to have a brief lunch because we have to stay on time, and I would ask the commission to be back at 1:30.
Tough taskmaster.
The chairman of the commission, Tom Kaine, has just announced that the commission will resume its hearings at 1:30 this afternoon, Eastern Time. You're listening to live coverage of hearings before the 9/11 Commission, the bipartisan commission appointed to investigate the September 11, 2001 attacks. The hearings are coming to you from NPR News in Washington. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and here with me in the little glass booth above the commission hearing room is Mary Louise Kelly. Mary Louise, we've been listening to witnesses talk today about the executive branch version of what was going on. We heard from CIA, from the Director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, and we heard from a person who was, in effect, his opposite number in the Clinton administration's inside the White House, the National Security Advisor, Sandy Berger. Most of what we have heard in the past, yesterday and today, has to do with the level of knowledge that the American government had as 9/11 approached. What was known, what was done, and what might have been done. And we've heard a lot of discussion, and including from Mr. Berger just now, that indicated that you can't evaluate events that were pre-9/11 in post-9/11 terms. I mean, there's been a surprising amount of agreement, it seems to me, among all of the people from the Bush administration and the Clinton administration about what was possible to do.
Yes. In fact, interestingly, we've heard unanimously from every witness so far. We're talking Secretary of State Albright and Secretary of Defense Bill Cohen in the Clinton administration, the current Secretary of State and Defense, and then today from CIA Director George Tenet, and just now, as you say, from National Security Advisor Sandy Berger from the Clinton administration, all of them agreeing that even if the decision, if the White House had wanted to go ahead and launch attacks on Afghanistan to try to take out al-Qaeda, try to eliminate the threat posed by Osama bin Laden, it would not have been possible before September 11th, saying that the opinion in the American public would not have supported it, that certainly they probably couldn't have gotten congressional approval for it, and they wouldn't have had international support, that allies needed in the region especially, such as Pakistan, would not have been on board, that it took September 11th to bring global public opinion to the point where that would have been possible.
Not to mention that President Clinton was in a considerable amount of political trouble himself at home, coping with impeachment. At a time when just about any action that he might have taken would have been interpreted as an attempt to change the subject.
I suppose now, as every action taken by the Bush administration is interpreted in the light of it being an election year. So, yes, it's true. Politics, of course, always coming into play here and the subtext for a lot of what we're hearing here.
One of the issues that was raised today and has been raised before was the Central Intelligence Agency and its understanding of its mandate. Did the Central Intelligence Agency have the authority or understand itself to have the authority to get bin Laden to the effect, in effect, if they could find Osama bin Laden, to kill him?
This is a really interesting point of contention that has emerged this morning. We just heard National Security Advisor from the Clinton administration, Sandy Berger, saying, look, there was no mistaking what the administration's intent was, particularly after the cruise missiles were launched in 1998 in retaliation for the attacks on U.S. embassies. He says, There was just no confusion. We wanted to kill bin Laden. We launched cruise missiles. If we'd had the intelligence, we would have acted him. We wanted him out. There was no confusion. If there was any confusion down the ranks, it was never communicated to me. We heard a very different take on that from CIA Director George Tenet. And, in fact, in the 9/11 Commission's preliminary report this morning, they spell out that, quote, every CIA official interviewed on this topic by the commission from DCI Tenet down, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, told us they heard a different message. They said that they read the relevant authorities signed by President Clinton as instructing them to try to capture bin Laden. So CIA officials saying it was not clear they had legal lethal authority. And Director Tenet made this point that there's a big difference between the authority to kill bin Laden and the capability to kill bin Laden.
There was also a lot of discussion on the coal, that after the United States ship, the coal, was damaged by an attack, that there was no retaliation. This was right at the end of the Clinton administration. And then after the administration changed hands and it was definitively discovered that it had been an al-Qaeda bin Laden operation, then the Bush administration did not retaliate either.
Well, the timing, of course, of the USS Cole is what was so tricky. The USS Cole in Yemen was bombed on October 12, 2000, and so it came very much at the tail end of the Clinton administration. Clinton administration officials testifying here saying we didn't have the definitive intelligence saying it was al-Qaeda. How could we retaliate without that?
And arguing, excuse me, and also arguing that that would not have been a supportable decision to retaliate in any way until there was some final determination that that's what it was. And we've had some very spirited questions about that over the past 2 days. And I expect that they will continue this afternoon when the committee hears from Richard Clark, former National Coordinator for Counterterrorism, who's written a controversial book, highly critical of the Bush administration's conduct of the war on terror. This has been a live broadcast of hearings before the 9/11 Commission. We'll resume at 1:30 Eastern with Mary Louise Kelly. I'm Linda Wertheimer, NPR News.
This is AM 580 WILL Urbana, and we will resume our live coverage from National Public Radio when the hearings resume at 12:30 Central Time. Our programming here on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast also made possible by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. They provide a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us today. We're going to have an abbreviated version of the noon hour of the afternoon magazine. And the host, of course, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up at 1 minute past noon, news from NPR that will be followed by AM 580 News. Scott Althoff will have weather at 12:14, and we'll take a look at the markets at 12:25. Let's take a quick look at the markets now. May wheat 4.16.